Thank you. Thank you very, very much, Fairfax. Welcome, everyone, and good evening. I just want to say what a real pleasure it is to be back in Marfa. I've been coming to Marfa on and off for, I would say, about 15 years. Actually, no, much more than that, since the early 90s. And I think for that reason, it's especially a pleasure to see Marianne Stockbrand and Thomas Kalein right here joining us this evening, because Marianne was always very gracious and very giving of her time and energy. Something I don't need to tell all of you. But even before, I think she was aware of my work, perhaps, and what I was sort of trying to do with my own curatorial practice. I always got the sense that Marfa was a very welcoming place, and indeed the turnout tonight, so many artists, people who work with artists and others here with us tonight, I think is testimony to the success of the Chinati Foundation in particular, and now Ballroom Marfa as well, and the Judd Foundation, in making Marfa into something that previously had not existed in the United States. And I think the aspect of it that I'm the most interested in, as it pertains to tonight's conversation, is this idea of a new way of looking at an art center, or how you conceive of an art center, or a new way of looking at a model for art centers in this day and time. It's probably worth mentioning that I think, as everyone's aware, we don't really live in an age of art centers, or at least art capitals, in the way that we once did, whereas, you know, once it was only Paris, and then it was perhaps Paris, Moscow, Berlin, and New York, and some would say Dusseldorf, some would say London, you know, but it was always this idea of a handful of centers. Really, the international art community, and probably global art has had a big part to play in all this, has essentially fractured and reassembled itself as many dozens of potential and possible art centers. And I think what defines them is where art activity takes place. Now, tonight, what we have is a panel discussion of three artists from New Orleans. These three artists are all participating in an exhibition that Fairfax and Virginia, the Ballroom Marfa, have invited me to curate for March. It opens March 18th and 19th. I hope you'll come for the opening. And it really grew out of some conversations that we all had, because I noticed that both of the founders of Ballroom Marfa seemed to be very taken with the, let's just say, the particular or peculiar situation that New Orleans found itself in around 2006, 2007, in the first couple of years after the federal levee break. We don't refer to it as Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. That's way too misleading and inaccurate. It's the federal levee break that happened in 2005. The city's situation was a very strange one, because many, many people in the art world, people of goodwill, of sensitivity, wanted to do something, wanted to respond in a way that was meaningful. They were somewhat hampered by the fact that for the last 40 years, the art world, as we know it in the United States, has effectively ignored all artistic activity in the city of New Orleans. Why that's true is a very complicated story, and I'm not sure how much we'll be able to get into tonight to satisfy you. Perhaps we might simply open the question and come up with a few potential answers. Certainly this relationship, this distance, cultural distance, I would call it, between, say, New Orleans and New York is a two-way street. It's not simply a question of New Orleans being ignored. It's also, I think, sometimes New Orleans wanting to be ignored, or simply wanting to look down on New York. And in fact, that's the conceit very much of the exhibition that I'm organizing for Ballroom. It's a take on, well, obviously, the world according to Garp. The title of the exhibition is The World According to New Orleans, which sounds indeed like a conceit. But it starts off with the idea of the John Irving book, the idea that You look at the world from a person's, from one individual's perspective, and it's bound to be very skewed. It's bound to be idiosyncratic. It also takes its title from a very important history of New Orleans that was published a couple of years ago by the music historian Ned Sublette. It's called The World That Made New Orleans. And that particular book looks at New Orleans in a way that few historians have, by tracing its musical roots back through the origins of slavery and the slave trade in New Orleans, and how one way of considering the unique musical position of New Orleans in terms of American music is to think about Congo Square, and how New Orleans was the only city, in fact it was the slave trading capital of the United States, it was the only city that actually permitted slaves to always have Sundays off, and to devote part of Sundays to an African market where goods that were made in slaves' spare time were sold and traded, and a drumming circle. That's Congo Square was host every Sunday night for literally centuries in this country of drumming rituals, drumming and chanting rituals. And it's now believed that many of the patterns that were brought over, that this is the only perhaps trace of an Atlantic passageway that we can discern in which culture literally was transplanted from Africa to the New World through knowledge accumulated by first free people, then slaves, and then through generations of slaves back to being free people again and into the hands of Buddy Bolden and Louis Armstrong and many, many others. So this idea that the world that made New Orleans introduced many people, including New Orleanians, including myself, to a different way of looking at the history and culture of New Orleans, and especially the very important historical role that music plays there, was really important to me. I fell in love with New Orleans really at first sight when I went in 1987 at the invitation of the artist Peter Halley. Now, this is where the story gets perhaps a little odd, because at that time I was beginning my career quite seriously as a curator and a writer. I was also a part-time musician, and I had a band, as it seemed everybody in the East Village at that time did, and Peter Halley was quite intrigued by this idea that I was not just trying to do the exhibitions that I was doing, I was also creating and recording music with friends of mine. He decided that I should come to New Orleans and see what that was like. And I have to say, my first experience of the art world in New Orleans was not that, it didn't make such a deep impression on me, although I met many people on that very first trip who later became very close to me. What did make a big impression on me was Jazz Fest. On the last day of my visit, I spent the afternoon at Jazz Fest by myself, and I remember that as kind of an epiphany happened, as the sun was going down and I had my first softshell crab po' boy and the Neville Brothers, and suddenly I had all this pleasure and joy bombarding me in a way that I, a born and bred Yankee, was simply not used to. I often like to say that the way I was always raised, understanding pleasure was through one sense at a time. You know, you didn't eat while you were listening to music. You didn't dance while you were in a museum. You know, you separated out the senses. And in New Orleans, I discovered that's not really the way it's done. If you're engaged by pleasure or sensorial stimulation one way, it's quite natural to keep opening up other ways of stimulating sensory stimulation. And one of the things I've noticed that's characteristic of New Orleans, for example, is it's very important as a city that consumes and creates a lot of music to always have great music around. And it's, you insist on that in New Orleans. The music must always be of the highest possible quality. And again, I, as a Yankee, would think that that would mean that what people do when there's good music going on in New Orleans is they sit and listen to it. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, once the good music is there, that's just a layer that you begin building on. And then you eat and you talk and you dance and you do other things. Once I had my first taste of New Orleans that way, I realized something was missing from my life. I'd never quite felt as alive, and since 1987, I have not missed a Jazz Fest. So I'm 24 years and counting. I guess the local expression for me is a never-lefter, like I went home from New Orleans, but I never left, and then I'm the species jazz fest. So never left her jazz fest. I began plotting ways to come back to New Orleans as much as possible. People in the New Orleans art world noticed this and began inventing opportunities for me to come to New Orleans. And I think both Dan Tague and Serge Longcar, when they were graduate students at UNO, were witness to at least one of my visits to campus, where I would simply come down at the invitation of the faculty, of the fine arts faculty, and talk to the students about what I was doing. And what I would really do was eat food and listen to music while I was there. So you can imagine that it wasn't that unusual for me by about 2000 to have decided that no matter what else happened in my career, I would probably wind up in New Orleans. I thought this was a good way to think about one's declining years, one's encroaching dotage, and I thought New Orleans was the place to do this. Well, before those plans had any opportunity to mature, the federal levees collapsed following that hurricane, whose name we all know, and suddenly I, like the rest of the country, was watching New Orleans on CNN, unable to believe what was happening to the city that was really so dear to me. My phone started ringing the next day from friends in New Orleans, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is going to be very difficult for me because people have lost everything in some cases, or they don't know what they have lost, and I'm going to have to be working with them to deal with this loss. Well, that wasn't why people were calling me. After Katrina, oops, I said it, they were calling me because they wanted to know if I wanted to come down to New Orleans and take part in a kind of community-based dialogue amongst the visual arts world about where to go, how to culturally rebuild the city. Now, this was long before anyone was back, so people didn't really even know that there was a city to come back to, and yet everyone seemed to be fully invested in this idea of rebuilding New Orleans culturally. And I think the germ of the idea of my collaboration with the city of New Orleans came from those first series of phone calls. I finally made it down to New Orleans in January 2006. And as a result of that first visit, which had a kind of a town hall meeting with about, in a room not very different from this one, filled with about 200 people from the arts community, many of whom had indeed lost their homes, their studios, their life's work, family members, and were still in, I would say, a deeply traumatized state. The idea of doing a biennial for New Orleans was given birth from those discussions. It was simply brought up what could be done to help the city. We narrowed it down to a signature event. We quickly eliminated the idea of an art fair, although people were looking kind of jealously at Miami at that point and saying, why can't we do the same thing? But more on that later. And I finally said, but you know, New Orleans would be a perfect place for biennial. It really is shaped the right way, and it's set up the right way, and the city's kind of a big participatory artwork anyway, where everybody's just always getting in on the act, and you know, it's a very overlapping kind of a culture. And one thing led to another, and by 2006, the middle of that year, I was fully dedicated to this idea, to making a biennial. I want to kind of skip over Prospect itself, because that's not the purpose of the discussion, but what I would like to say is that by making a commitment, which was in fact a 10-year commitment, to the city of New Orleans, I had big plans in mind for the city, and continue to have. The idea that the United States does not and has never had and supported an international biennial on a large scale. We have a couple of biennials that are not in any way nothing I want to dismiss or belittle, but certainly if you think about Venice or Sao Paulo, Istanbul, Shanghai, the cities of the world that have great biennials, important and influential biennials, we've never, ever attempted that. And I curate international biennials as part of my own vocation, so it's particularly of concern to me that United States, up until recently, has opted out of that way of approaching culture. And I thought, well, if New Orleans wants to heal itself and rebuild itself, and the United States does not have a biennial, and I love New Orleans, and I curate biennials, well, coming up with the idea of a biennial for New Orleans didn't seem impossible. it seemed like something I could actually do. So I did start a company, as Fairfax mentioned. I never thought I would be a startup nonprofit entrepreneur at the age of 50, but that's what happened. It turned out to be the only way to make it happen. And I realized at that point that I was committing myself to something else. And over time, I've realized that that's maybe the most important thing that I made my commitments to, which is not the city of New Orleans as such. It's the artist community of New Orleans. I think this is where I'm going to take it. My remarks are going to take a particular turn and include my fellow panelists, simply to say that what I've discovered in New Orleans is that this is a city that is host or home to one of the largest and most exciting and I would say productive art communities in the country, I'd say dynamic qualities and energy is in inverse proportion to what the rest of the country seems to know about it. In fact, the more I've been living in New Orleans, I bought a house there in 2007, and I now divide my time half and half between New Orleans and New York, where we raise all the money. I have really begun to understand that most of America, it's not just an art world thing, most of the United States knows almost nothing about New Orleans. And for being such a universally recognized quantity, this lack of information and sort of, I would say, exoticization in the absence of real knowledge has been one of the things that's really hurt the city in the long run. I did not expect to find so many remarkable artists living and working in New Orleans as I have found. And so from that perspective, my role as a curator who's committed himself to New Orleans is made so much easier by the fact that I can find artists whose work is extremely engaging and exciting to me without having to look very hard. And I can make many exhibitions from these artists' work and never feel like I'm having to drop the bar in terms of quality. We've just opened the last of five exhibitions that are part of a 18-exhibition program called Prospect 1.5, which we hope will be the pilot for an interval year program. In other words, a program that happens between biennials that, unlike the biennial, focuses 80% on local artists. Prospect 1.5 has 50 participating artists, and 40 of them have direct ties to New Orleans. So you'd think, wow, 40 artists plus as many as it takes to be in a biennial, plus as many as, you know, we go into the programs at Contemporary Arts Center, plus there's Prospect 2. You know, Dan must be running out of good artists pretty soon. I mean, how, it's not that big a city. How can there be so many interesting artists there? Well, I can't really explain why. It's just the facts as I'm discovering them on the ground. So what I'd like to do now is give you a little bit more information about the other panelists. Skylar Fine and Sergin Longcar were both participating artists in Prospect 1. Serge is from Croatia. Dan is from the Bronx.
Skylar.
Sorry. Skylar's from the Bronx. Dan is from, well, Dan's from Marrero. Dan's from the New Orleans region. I've known, actually, Serge's and Dan's work for more than 10 years. I've known them both as graduate students on my regular trips to New Orleans. Serge created, I think, one of the most compelling and talked about installations in Prospect 1, but it was really in many ways Skylar's work that surprised people, because Skylar hadn't, and correct me if I'm wrong, hadn't even been an artist in 2005. It was actually the trauma of the events and his own kind of personal recovery after 2005 that kind of forced the situation, if you will. Dan Taig is one of the, I would say, one of the most influential younger artists living and working in New Orleans. And Dan and Serge, just before Prospect 1 opened, began a cooperative gallery in New Orleans called Good Children, which spearheaded a movement of now, I would say, close to a dozen cooperative galleries that are all in the St. Claude Avenue. It's the district that connects the 7th Ward, the Upper 9th Ward and Bywater, but it's spread along St. Claude Avenue, going all the way up to the bridge to the Lower 9th Ward. Many, if not all, but there's a big density of artistic creators, including a lot of musicians that live in that neighborhood. So it's an especially apt place to have that kind of neighborhood. But I particularly wanted Skylar and Dan and Serge to represent New Orleans tonight because of their own their respective roles in helping to rebuild the city. And the more that I've thought about the idea, the more I realize after 2005, New Orleans began to embark on a long chapter of volunteerism in which everyone, it seemed, had to wear multiple hats in order to regain and rebuild the community. And I think I'll start with that as kind of an open question to the three artists, which is, you know, how has your life been as an artist, especially in the last sort of 5 or 6 years when you've got all of this kind of struggle? You're dealing with the idea that most of America doesn't know who you are or hasn't shown much interest in New Orleans art until now. And yet at the same time, there seems to be this moment, this opportunity, something that you can really take advantage of. Serge, you look like you want to like dive in with an answer.
What's that? No. But yes. But I don't know. I think you said everything already, you know. I don't know what else to say. But I think I can...
I have a habit of that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but that's okay. Yeah. You went through the galleries and everything else, but, you know, but that's fine. But I think what's important or whatever, like even especially right now with New Orleans, I think what happened after Katrina was like this kind of like a blank slate, like tabula rasa, like anything can happen, like to be rebuilt or whatever, even culturally or even physically. But I have to say, like, I am kind of saddened that, you know, that I think our state and even government kind of failed of not making like an example, like after, you know, our disaster that happened or whatever, and that the city could have been rebuilt into this kind of like a model kind of town, you know, city.
And it never happened.
And never happened or whatever. But I have to say at the same time that that disaster and that this like kind of like new point or whatever, like just attracted artists, you know, from all around the country, you know. Just like heard like just people just like moving down even for volunteering to help or whatever, or just even just going down there and like making the artwork, you know. So I think I don't know, it was a bad thing that happened to us, you know, down there, but like at the same time I think it kind of maybe like shifted the direction of the city, of, you know, what was happening over there, because I think of New Orleans as being throughout the history or whatever very like introverted and very secluded or whatever, just thinking about its own food, music, culture, and, you know, not kind of like grasping for like outside information or whatever. Everything is like evolved about, you know, festivals and, you know, whatever it's like.
In a way, shunning this influence of the outside world and
exactly
insisting on this,
yes,
kind of insularity.
Correct. And I think, like, even this, like, disaster or whatever, there was, like, a silver lining or whatever that, like, it really kind of attracted new, you know, kind of, like, breed of artists or whatever that wanted to be there, that wanted to, like, create something new and so forth.
Dan, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, clean slate is not really, I mean, that's a lot more optimistic than I thought. Because okay, we were on a roof together for 7 days after levees broke. We thought it was going to be a party. We evacuated for 2 hurricanes just before that and spent 19 hours to get to Houston. So we're like, no way, this is going to be crap. They're lying again. It's not going to be that bad. If it was that bad, they would have, of course, called mandatory evacuation, and they didn't. So it's a, you know, it's just going to be a storm, and it will blow away. Then the, you know, water went 6 feet in our neighborhood, and we're on a roof for 7 days till we got pulled off. And I thought that was the end of the world as I knew it. Done. Went to New York with my $300 and Red Cross money until my bank accounts magically appeared again because they were all inaccessible forever. And so my only thing was that artists would call and like, where are you at? I'm in North Carolina. I'm in L.A. I'm in New York. I'm in Chicago. I'm in, you know, upstate Louisiana. Like, just everywhere, this artistic diaspora. And a hat that I wore almost immediately landing in New York, I mean, like within weeks, was like contacting art centers and trying to curate shows just to bring these people together, because I didn't want the New Orleans identity of artists to be gone forever. At least if we're going to live everywhere in other places forever, at least we could have this identity of we were New Orleans artists. We had this thing we're building, you know, and it got crushed. So, and then, you know, Dan came along and it's like it became, and I'm not, you know, we had this identity. And you said, you know, there's so many artists in New Orleans, but we didn't have the voice. We had the work. We had, you know, everyone was there. We had this army of artists, but it just didn't have a voice. Didn't have this national audience, this big attention. And people coming after the storm, after Katrina and after devastation, were all of a sudden realizing there was a lot more there than Mardi Gras. There was more there than Jazz Fest. There's more there than food. There's actually real people that live there. There's actually real artists with a lot to say. And all of a sudden, you know, they're getting recognized here and here and, you know, picking up residencies all over until they can decide to go back or try to rebuild or, you know, decide what they're going to do with their life now because everything was gone. And then I guess right when people started deciding we're going to move back, and then this idea of Prospect came along, and people really started to pay attention, and they really noticed, like, wow, New Orleans has some amazing art there. And now, you know, droves of, like, I mean, these co-ops are popping up, and people are moving to New Orleans. Like, it's how amazing, not just passing through, like, coming to visit and never leaving. Now they're staying. Grad schools, I mean, there's, you know, there's 4 grad programs. And now they're not getting their degree and leaving. They're getting their degree and staying and, you know, and contributing. And it's growing by the second. It's pretty amazing stuff.
What's your experience been, Skylar?
You know, these guys are so positive. They've brought me here to provide balance. New Orleans is doomed. it's doomed. And that's part of what I love about it.
Well, that was very interesting.
I wasn't an artist when Katrina hit. I was a student. I wanted to be a doctor. And I wanted to be one of those groovy doctors. So I was pre-med at University of New Orleans. And after the storm, I lost the house. My partner and I lost the rental house that we were in. The storm took the roof off it, and we needed furniture. So I decided that I would try to use some of the wood that was in the street to build a kitchen table. You ever do that? You ever look at like some piece of junk and say, like, I'm going to make something out of this, you know? But you never do. You probably throw it in your backyard or something. So I started hauling all this wood into my backyard that was just in the street everywhere. We literally needed a kitchen table. I went to the hardware store and got a drill, and I just figured I was going to put a table together somehow. I found 4 matching table legs in the street. Matching. They were obviously from the same table. And I figured I got to figure out some way to stick these legs onto this tabletop. It's still our kitchen table. It's not made the way you would like probably make a kitchen table. But, I mean, it holds together. And I took some time to compose the tabletop out of different colored boards. And a neighbor who taught architecture at LSU, at Louisiana State, saw the tabletop. And he said, you know, you could put that on the wall. He said, it's kind of like a color field painting made out of wood. And I thought, you know, obviously he was more mentally ill than I was. But he told me he would pay. He would pay me money if I would make him one of these tabletops without legs. And I did. I think he gave me $250 or something. And I dragged it down to his house down the block, and I hung it over his drafting table where he does his sketches. And other architects saw it, and they wanted one. I think part of people could see that I was using the wreckage of the city to make something beautiful. And they liked it. I mean, they liked that it referenced a massive disaster, but maybe not in a terribly depressing way. And I guess it also made this uncontrollable force of nature controllable, because now it was square. So it sort of maybe made people feel safe. You could have it in your house or something. And architects liked it because it looked architectural. It looked like houses, you know. So they started asking for them, and so all week I was in school, pre-med, and then on the weekend I was in my backyard making these things. And it took me a long time actually to make one. And I derived a surprising amount of pleasure from doing it, and I figured it was some kind of a therapy for me to feel like I could have some control over this these terrible forces somehow. I was miserable all day in school. All morning in class, misery. All afternoon, homework, misery. And then all evening studying for the test the next day, misery. I mean, and I went, wow, I've created an entire day, a whole life of misery, where it's nothing but misery, and I have no one to blame but myself. So after a year of that, I had to admit, we admitted to ourselves and ultimately to others that I'd created a life of total misery. It was actually really hard to admit to myself and then to everybody else, this was the wrong thing. I've got to stop it. But in the meantime, I'm real happy on the weekend in my backyard. So maybe I can figure out some way to spend more time in my backyard making this stuff. And so then I did. I just said I'm going to spend as much time as I can in the backyard. I got a job in a warehouse in Harahan. And still making stuff. A guy who runs a gallery saw it in somebody's house and said, who is this guy? They contacted me and said, maybe we'll put you in a show. And I thought, wow, I'm going to have a piece in a real gallery? And that's, you know, that's how I ended up making art. Something's happening, something incredible is happening in New Orleans. And
it's doomed.
It's doomed. Yeah.
It's also doomed. But these two things are related. What's happening now is inextricably linked to the destruction, and nobody understands why. Nobody understands why. No one will ever understand why this clearing of the ground that happened. I mean, it's sort of like a forest fire returns the nutrients to the soil. It almost felt like Katrina just burnt our community to the ground, and it somehow returned the nutrients to the soil culturally in a way that will probably never make any kind of rational sense, but it really did. And the neighborhood that I live in is now home to at least 12 art spaces that have opened up in the last few years, and these guys are part of one. They're mostly collective artist spaces. I mean, I didn't think that I was setting up shop in like the kind of like scene, you know, that there was some scene. There was no scene, and now it's a scene. And it's totally connected to the destruction. And we'll be destroyed again. This is New Orleans between the floods. This is like Germany, like Weimar Germany, right, between the wars. This scene, this incredible cauldron of culture. This is New Orleans between the floods. There's no question it'll flood again. There's no question. The sea level's rising 9 millimeters a year off the coast of Louisiana, which is one of the highest rates of a sea level rise anywhere in the world. And not only is it rising 9 millimeters a year, but the rate of rise is speeding up. That's not going to stop. And, you know, we're the canary in the coal mine for rise in the sea level, for the dependence on fossil fuels and what we've seen with the
BP this year.
Yeah, with the oil spill. We are absolutely the canary in the coal mine. And to live in New Orleans is to be doing a dance on the lip of an active volcano. And it's a beautiful dance. And we love it. And we don't want to do that dance anyplace else. But we are absolutely doing this dance on the lip of an active volcano. And we're just going to love it until we can't love it anymore.
So I'm just going to extrapolate a little bit from that, which was great, by the way. Is it a kind of fate, like the moth to the flame? Are artists drawn to New Orleans because they want their life and career and vision to be extinguished in some kind of dramatic, tragic way, like just a puff, like the wave comes in and we all drown? And
I think always, like, artists were like attracted by any kind of crisis, you know, and like we are kind of like we can assimilate, you know, I think to crisis more than anybody else. I think us as artists or whatever, I'm in for the juice. I love, you know,
You're in it for the excitement.
Exactly, yes. So, for example, like I'm represented by a gallery, a commercial gallery in New Orleans, but like opening up a gallery, a collector gallery with my friends or whatever on the other side of the town, and just like bringing in like on the opening night like 300, 400 people or whatever, and just like, you know, really enjoying the artwork or whatever. And it's like really inexpensive artwork, and we don't sell anything, but it's just such a high that, you know, I just love it, you know. And I'm, you know, maybe pay through my nose or whatever to, you know, for the rent and anything else or whatever, and there is no profit. And I don't know, I think that's just, yeah, how I thought.
But then let me play devil's advocate to your devil's advocate. Why would any artist in their right mind want to live in a city where let me just tick a few things off.
Artist in their right mind.
left mine.
Why would artists in any kind of... why would artists with even a fleeting grasp of reality want to live in New Orleans where, you know, there's not a single major collector of contemporary art? There's no museum of contemporary art. There's really no institute, or there's practically not a center of contemporary art.
Is that like Marfa?
Pardon?
Is that like Marfa?
No, actually, no. It's almost the flip side. Although I think that we're edging up on certain very peculiar similarities and parallels, I would say, between New Orleans and Marfa. No, but I think the disadvantages. You know, every artist I know lives on the brink of total impoverishment from one month to another. The artist that Sarah's just mentioning, it seems like, you know, you can go out and buy anything in New Orleans, and it's incredibly valuable and meaningful, and it only costs $500, and you feel like, wait a minute, what kind of third world art market have I stepped into? And I'm thinking, is this just because of this peculiar way that artists are drawn to New Orleans, or does it have something to do with the fact that, for example, the Pew Charitable Trust recently surveyed American states to determine which were the happiest and which were the saddest, only to find out that New Yorkers were the most miserable of all, and the happiest state in the country is Louisiana. People just describe themselves as very, very happy all the time. What's going on here?
Drinking,
booze.
Lots of drinking. Drinking.
Festivals.
Decadence and drinking.
We have like...
It took me four years to get this answer, but thank you.
That's it.
And festivals. We have a lot of festivals. I think we have the most festivals, like every week or whatever, you're going to find like 2-3 festivals. It's insane to have a festival for everything,
for a microphone. I don't know. Dwarfed the art scene for a long time as well.
It's also what?
I think it dwarfed the arts for so long, having all these festivals. And now that we have a biannual festival dedicated to art, I think it's about time. It's long overdue that we can throw a festival together and have a million people there, like, you know, in an instant for plastic beads. But, I mean, now we have one for art, and there's such a great, you know, art community and such a draw, and people want to be there. People love the city. Without the institutions, people still want to be there. People move there. Finally there's something, you know, for the art to rival, you know, not to rival, to be in communion with the music and food and everything else.
Correct.
Well, I know several young art students, graduate students, young artists, curators, arts administrators from all around the country. I probably know 24 of them who've moved to New Orleans in just the past couple of years. And I think they're moving there in spite of the fact that there are really no substantive job offers for them there. They just want to be part of whatever it is they see is happening there.
Correct. But, you know, even again, like New Orleans, I think even like from the standpoint where we're talking about like from music and what Dan is saying about that food and stuff like that, like culture, I think it's like so, you know, saturated, you know, like so rich that every time that you walk out or whatever on the street or whatever, you're going to see something that's going to like blow your mind away and, you know, just that you're going to get inspired, you know, being as an artist or whatever. And then, you know, then you just have just the areas or whatever where, like, the artists hang out or whatever. And I think that's what other artists who are coming down or whatever, they're attracted to. That they say, like, okay, this is, like, even, like, a city slash, I think, always take it as a town, too, because, like, New Orleans, I don't think of it as a city, you know? I think it's just, like, this large town because everybody even knows each other and stuff like that, especially in the artist community, and you know, but I think that what's very, how should I say, that what people like about it to come down there, of course, it's first, I think it's very inexpensive, you know, to live there.
It's been very good for the recession,
correct,
for artists during the recession.
You know, I think like, I mean, for like an artist like being in New York or versus ours being in New Orleans, where it's like day and night or whatever, like you're gonna have like.
Well, I think the quality of life versus cost of living proportion is probably the best in the country.
Correct, yes. Yeah.
But, okay, tell me what you feel are some of the, I don't know, advantages of being in the city. I mean, what is it about New Orleans, if anything, that fuels the way you approach your work? Or is that so intangible that it can't
really... I don't even know.
Yes.
I mean,
I don't understand the question.
Being born in it, I can't tell the difference. I mean, when, like, for instance, like, someone can see, I don't know, certain type of like costume for a parade or something and just be floored by it. Where it, sometimes maybe I wish not being so moved. I miss not being so moved because it becomes almost commonplace.
And you'd be caught up in these moments
until I leave, and then I'm like, oh man, I really like to be there.
I think that was David Simon, the creator of The Wire on HBO, and now the series Tremé, described it as saying, New Orleans, we used to have a culture. This used to be a country that manufactured things. We manufactured cars, we manufactured furniture, we manufactured great technology, and now we really don't do any of that anymore. And what New Orleans manufactures is moments. That it's a city that gives you just these most extraordinary moments in which inexplicable and often bizarre things seem to happen all the time and draw you into them. I mean, anyone who reads A Confederacy of Dunces and is from New Orleans realizes that that's not a farce.
No,
that's actually how life is lived in New Orleans on a steady basis.
Yeah.
I have a paradoxical kind of issue in my mind, because the title of this panel is Red-Haired Stepchild, and it reflects back on that first conversation I had in January 2006, where a woman stood up and complained. She said, look, we're a city where musicians outnumber visual artists probably like 5-1, and the visual artists have... I mean, the musical community, pardon me, has, you know, Harry Connick Jr. and Wynton Marsalis and just all these really famous people out there to root for it. And, you know, you look at the culinary world, you know, the world of eating, fine dining in New Orleans, which is a very important art form. And there are just so many famous chefs, John Besh and Emeril Lagasse, and, you know, they're out there rooting for it. And then you have, you know, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie kind of trying to expand the... design and architecture participation in the recovery of the city. And she said, and here I am, a visual artist, and I feel like a redheaded stepchild, because we're in this city where no one knows who we are. No one even knows we exist, including the people of our own city. And yet we're all here. We're all part of it. And then, of course, just to flip back over to the conceit of the exhibition, The World According to New Orleans, for me, as a title for an exhibition surveying New Orleans art, is based on a kind of a thought exercise that I had for myself, where I said, what would our canon be like? What would our artistic canon be if, in place of New York as the capital of American art in the 20th century, that capital had been New Orleans? Who would be the Jackson Pollocks, the Donald Judds, the Andy Warhol of that history? And how would you break that history apart? So when you see the exhibition, I think it'll be a little bit clearer just kind of what sort of an idea I'm trying to build. But I do think this idea that New Orleans looks at the world in its own way, and it's that worldview that maybe is the most compelling about this city, is I think what's kind of underlying this discussion and this exhibition. And I think in the end, my own very passionate involvement in the city for the last 5 years. What do you think about this world according to New Orleans? I mean, how does New Orleans see the world?
New Orleans see the world?
Or see itself in the world.
Well, I think it goes back a little bit to that survey you were saying. I don't know if you saw it in the paper. Louisiana was the number one happiest state, self-reported happiness. New Yorkers were, in fact, the most miserable. Big surprise about New York, isn't it? But a few weeks after that, there was another survey, hours worked per capita. I don't know if you saw this. Louisiana had the lowest hours worked per capita in the country. The headline in the paper was, Louisiana, laziest state, which I thought was completely off, right? I mean, that's a fair analysis, but I think it's wrong. I think that there's something else going on in Louisiana, which you might be familiar with in Marfa, too, which is that there's something else that's important besides productivity. I mean, New York is like, this capitalist labor camp where, you know, everyone keeps telling you how great they're in the best labor camp there is. You know, they get the most done. And in New Orleans, it's anything but. I mean, people really, really prize their time, their time spent cooking food and enjoying it with each other. Their time spent with loved ones and friends, their time spent sitting on their stoop. And it's not about laziness. I mean, it really is about like a pre-capitalist way of life.
It's about socializing too, what you said too, you know?
And it's about intimacy. Yeah. I mean, it's like people are more in touch with the things that really create happiness in your life, which isn't so much about your productivity. And it's more about like your real relationships you have and the time you spend intimately with your friends and family. And I think that's what people really care about there, and maybe here too. I mean, New Orleans is another small town.
But do you think this is maybe dovetailing almost into pat a fashion with a lot of the kind of concerns of recent art practice, which are focusing exactly on social interaction, kind of immaterial desires and the immaterial dimension of life, the kind of like movement away from just more productivity and more objects and more things made, and towards just a different philosophical position. Like, what is the artist's role in society? Is it to make more things and put them out there, or is it to present another way of looking at how we live our lives? It seems to be that what you're saying is,
yes,
is a little bit of that.
The art of living. I mean, that's what we're working on.
It's a rich, it's a fertile territory in that regard. But you're back to saying about how you, how do I think like most people in New Orleans would view themselves in a broader view? I don't think they would. I think they think they're the center of the universe. I'm pretty sure that's. I just imagine that growing up. I mean.
I mean, discovering that Mardi Gras wasn't a national holiday was.
I just thought it was like the biggest thing on the planet, like, and that's it. Like, there's nothing else, right?
Maybe it's the ability to convince everyone, including themselves, that what happens in New Orleans is more important than what happens anywhere else in the world. That's
Hello,
the secret to
yes.
it. Again, 4 years it took me to be able to say, thank you all very much for helping. I don't know. I does anyone want to talk about any other functional or practical parts of the city, or do we want to maybe open it up a little bit to a conversation? Because the thing about New Orleanians is that not only do they think they live in the most interesting place in the world, they can also talk for a really long time about how interesting their city is. And that'll eventually get to what they had for lunch yesterday, which was, of course, the most interesting.
I mean, we could also have an entire lecture on problems that we have as well, which, you know, as any city does. Like, you know,
we're waiting.
Education, I mean, yep. I mean, that's, you know, that's going to be the future of our city and the future of art, and it just seems like there's less and less emphasis on education, on arts in schools, on, it's just shrinking and diminishing by the second. But salaries in big government aren't really shrinking or diminishing by the second. That's pretty odd.
Odd how? Wait, can you say more?
It's just odd that any funding that goes in education in New Orleans, in Louisiana as a whole, but New Orleans seems more specific to this point, that they'll build one charter school instead of opening up the other eight neighborhood schools. So it kind of neglects 80% of the kids in the city. Just that's it. Screw you. And if you're selected and good enough, then you can come here and there'll be a good enough school and an art program that's half funded and a lot less funded now, and with our new governor, funded less by the second. It seems to be the first cut on the chopping block. But raises for all of these people keep coming. And the superintendent just got a $100,000 raise, but teachers get cut. They're raised, you know, if you want to work there, I mean, you're pretty much, you need a second job to be a teacher there.
You need a trust fund.
That's pretty horrible. That's insane. Like, and they wonder, like, why is education failing? Because it's not going into kids. So, of course, it's going to fail. Of course, you know, you're going to not, you know, jobs are going to be uncommon and crime's going to raise. And it, all of these issues are always going to come up that way. It just seems like a lot of politicians are so short-sighted. Like, they want to know, like, how do we get over this first hurdle to survive 6 months instead of looking, how can we be better in 20 years? It's a lot of short-sightedness that, you know, the artists need to take over the government and just, it would all be so much better.
I think we should hear what they have to say.
I do too. Have any questions in the room? Or no, I know we do. Yes, please.
You guys love New Orleans. What neighborhood do each one of you live in or work in? What neighborhood do you each work in? How does that affect your
life? Great question.
You know the city?
A little bit.
Well, I live in Treme, and I picked Treme because for a few different reasons. I didn't really know that much about the history of the neighborhood back in when I started looking in early 2007. But it was close enough to the friend of mine in the French Quarter who had been my mentor in New Orleans, who's getting on in age. And I knew I couldn't live in the French Quarter, but I knew I wanted to live fairly close. And to be honest, it was on the walking route between his house and Jazz Fest. So I had actually passed through the neighborhood several times. And Treme is it's the oldest African-American neighborhood in the United States. In fact, this is its bicentennial year. And I guess I realized that all I had to do was step off Esplanade, and I was in this other neighborhood where, you know, really like more working class families, African-American predominantly, were just sitting out on their stoops in these spectacular houses and being just very friendly all the time to everybody walking by. And when I first started looking at a house and I realized rents in the first couple of years after Katrina were so exorbitant I couldn't even imagine paying rent in the city, I realized I almost had to buy. And that was just the first neighborhood I thought of, and the first house I went to was the house I wound up buying, and it has a huge, huge influence on my work and on my life, because I've lived in the Lower East Side for 30 years in Manhattan, and I guess I feel like the neighborhood I moved to back in 1979 is now the neighborhood I moved to in 2007. Like all of that street interaction, all of the socializing that goes on in that kind of a neighborhood, the fact that neighbors always know where each other are and they always look out for each other. You know, I grew up in a small village in upstate New York, and I really appreciate that kind of an intimacy in a neighborhood. And I like being part of an historic neighborhood that's rebuilding itself, and where the city of New Orleans, after generations of telling tourists, right, never, ever step foot in Treme, are now forced to put it on the tourist maps because of the success of the HBO series, and they're scrambling to try to find cultural landmarks and retail or do something in the neighborhood because there's not really any infrastructure outside of the cultural infrastructure, which is unbelievably rich.
Mm. I live in the Ninth Ward in Bywater. As far as I'm concerned, it's the epicenter of this new renaissance of art going on, and there was always a lot of artists. It just seems to be so amped up and so exciting right now. It's pretty outrageous. And, you know, we all live there together. We celebrate together. We mourn together. It's a community, and just like every other part of the city. And it's, of course, it's a tremendous aspect of your work. You know, it's hard to separate sometimes the city from your work and who you are. It's almost impossible at times, which is kind of the tremendous thing about New Orleans. And people can be there for only a short time and instantly, it's not a matter of like, oh, I get it. It's a matter of, I am it. Like where, like you, all of a sudden you find yourself and you're like, shit, like I am New Orleans. I am this thing. I am part of this bigger conglomerate, and you can just feel it. It's even hard to explain. It's just an amazing thing.
I live 5 minutes walking distance away from the French Quarter. It's called the Marigny. And actually, I bought a house over there from the government, like just before the storm. And we got the whole house out, and then the storm happened or whatever. And then actually, like all the houses were, you know, to my level of my house or whatever, you know.
Gutted,
you know. It's almost like, you know, the starting point or whatever. But like what he was saying too, of like the bad stuff or whatever that happens or whatever, like. You know, like, I don't have any, like, drainage on my street, you know? Like, when it rains or whatever, like, there's, like, huge, you know, things of water, like, that I have to, like, you know, jump over and stuff like that. And there's, like, kids playing in that during the summer with, like, mosquitoes and everything else and stuff like that. So there's big problems or whatever. But then, again, somehow, you know, what he said too, or whatever, with the moth or whatever going to the lamp or whatever, like, somehow we are attracted to that because there's, like, as I said too, like so many characters and so many things that's happening over there that you know, I wouldn't change for a thing or whatever, you know? Like, I don't know, like I was like changing sills on my house, on the side of the house, and I even had like a friend of mine, an artist from Chicago, like showing me how to do it or whatever, to change the base of my house or whatever. And then before you know it, like just down my streets or whatever, like just like this white horse without a saddle just like starts like galloping down or whatever, you know, and we just look at each other. And then there was like these, just you know, a bunch of black kids on the bikes or whatever, just like yelling and like screaming after him and like just like following him or whatever. And the guy, you know, from Chicago, he said like, "Serge, you know, I really, this is why I miss the city or whatever, because like just like stuff like this, you know, out of nowhere, just, you know, just appears or whatever, you know."
A lot of parades.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Parades all the time.
Yeah, I live in the same neighborhood basically as these guys. I mean, I live in the Marigny. We all live pretty much within walking distance of each other, what's called downtown in New Orleans. And that doesn't mean the place with the tall buildings. That's not that. Downtown is downriver. So we live downtown, all of us. And that's like the traditional working class to poor neighborhoods of the city. And it's beautiful. And it's probably... you know, my partner and I, sometimes when we were uptown, we go, "Do you think we could live here? Could we afford it?" But I just can't picture myself ever living there. I mean, I don't think I could make art there. I think, like, you know, art comes from war. It comes from struggle and conflict. I mean, has any good art ever been made at Club Med? I mean, will it ever be? You know, I can't see it, you know? So maybe it's, like, completely unhealthy of me, but I love our neighborhood, and I feel a tremendous attachment to it.
Yeah, we tend to get our, I don't know where you get your vegetables, but there's a guy with a truck who drives around my neighborhood, Mr. Okra, and he just has this like little PA system, and he just is calling it, and he's like, "I got yellow peppers, I got
peaches,
watermelons," and then uptown, which is where the money is, well, they have Whole Foods, and that's the dichotomy of New Orleans right there, and you know, and sometimes we want the people from uptown who obviously have all the money. To come downtown to visit our spaces and look at our shows and buy their art. But they're afraid they're going to get shot, right? Yeah. What are they afraid of, Serge? They're going to get shot. Yeah. That's probably it. Yeah, everyone's agreeing with me. They're afraid they're going to get shot.
Just scared of the puddles.
Next quality of life question.
You've got to learn to play in them, not jump over them.
That was a long-winded answer. Probably we've intimidated the second questioner, clearly. Yes, please.
Well, I just wanted to ask, you talked about how there's the longest time New Orleans has sort of had a kind of narcissism, and it sort of, in a way, shuns some external influences. And obviously, it seems like the rest of the country is cluing into within arts communities about what's happening in New Orleans. Is the city itself, is there any bridging, like in terms of, say, local patronage, you know, obviously you have the money uptown and whatnot. And New Orleans is it's a poor city with a really thin, wealthy upper crust.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any, like, is that connecting at all? Because it seems like so many, there's kind of an artist from the lens, it seems like. So at the artist level, things look great, but as far as you said, you're having to bring in resources from outside, is any of that showing the signs of change?
I'm afraid your question is directed at me, isn't it?
Well, I'm just wondering, any of you, did you get that sense that, like, how the arts and contemporary arts are regarded in New Orleans, is that changing at all? Because it seems like the longest time before the storm, it was, it was the redhead stepchild. It seemed like you could fit the arts community in a kind of small space. It felt like it was in need. It seems like there's a lot of tension from the outside. I'm just wondering, do you get the sense things are changing on the ground outside of, like, the immediate artist communities in terms of the regard for the artists?
But I don't think the artists could ever be fit into a small space. I think there just wasn't the collective base and the institution base that could promote it to make it seem like, wow, look what we have in, you know, in these dark spaces in the city. There was just never a light shown on it. And as far as collective base and that kind of thing, I think that is relatively small, and hopefully it changes. But personally, I think a lot of the funding, I mean, that actually does come from outside of the city.
Yeah, I think we're finding that there's a Berlin factor that's playing out right now in New Orleans, where nationally, the arts journals and blogs, and you know, they seem really, really very well keyed into what's happening in New Orleans. We had a fantastic turnout for Prospect One, and I think there's been this kind of residual effect from that. But I am not seeing much of a really demonstrable positive change in terms of either, you know, patronage from the point of view of collecting, or what I think we could call enlightened cultural philanthropy. This is our biggest struggle right now. We raise 80% of the money for Prospect from outside the state of Louisiana, which means that's a relatively small sliver of the funding needs to come from within the city of New Orleans, let's say. And the money's there. It's clearly there. But it's being used and spent in some pretty, I would say, arbitrary ways that don't seem to be so much about civic mindedness as about the, I'm going to just say, the personal vanity of the people whose money it is. It's not a large enough city for there to be like a sprinkling of leading edge, cutting edge philanthropists. What happens, you then set the mark for everyone else to follow. What happens is there's kind of certain little fiefdoms that have been established, and people tend to spend money on pet projects, irregardless of what the benefit is for the artist community or what the benefit is for the city. It really doesn't seem to be occurring in a very informed or enlightened way. And you know, it's a constant struggle for us. I don't know about these guys.
Well, it's just starting. I mean, the biennial that Dan put on 2 years ago, the Prospect One, was the first time that sort of national level collectors showed up en masse into New Orleans. And I think they were pretty shocked by what they found and the quality of it. And some of them have come back to snap up bargains, because New Orleans is a place where they can pick up some bargains. So it's just starting. I think it's going to be 10 more years before that sort of can strengthen a little bit.
I mean, there does seem to be a real uptick around the country of opportunities for New Orleans artists. New exhibitions, collectors are appearing all around the country. They're just not appearing uptown. Quite the rate we're hoping for.
Well, we also live in the 49th poorest state. I mean, Louisiana, I think Mississippi is 50, so mm-hmm. we're 49. So, I mean, that reality shows up in our lives, in every aspect of our lives every day, and it doesn't matter where you're at on the class scale. It's going to show up in your life, and the wealthy in Louisiana are not the same as the wealthy, say, in New York. I mean, we're still the 49th, you know, in terms of wealth. So that's reality.
A little Marianne, yes.
Yeah, I'm a little interested in how the dynamics between the artists are, you know, the way they portray. You get a little bit of a sense that this was all one wonderful group of artists and bringing them together, and that there is a great sense of solidarity and I don't know what else. But it has to be a little bit more. Is there, you know, how often do you get together? What is your relationships? How do you show each other your work?
I don't know. I've been knowing Dan like since we went to the same school or whatever, and then even afterwards he started like picking up spaces and trying to curate shows or whatever. And actually, he put me in a couple of shows, and like we even traveled to Chicago and Kansas City and stuff like that. So I have to say, like you know, in the end, that there is a lot of like solidarity and you know, camaraderie or whatever. There is not, you know, like, you know, almost like, you know, backstabbing or, you know, anything. I think we're all in, you know, how should I say, we're fighting this, like, bigger, I think, animal or whatever, which, what even, like, Dan was saying or whatever, we're trying to, like, maybe get the uptown people or whatever and, you know, the collector's mindset or whatever to change from, instead of, like, acquiring like, antiques and, you know, and jazz, you know, portraits and stuff like that, of like investing into like contemporary art and into video work and you know installation work and to recognize it as valuable and stuff like that. So I think, in a sense, you know, I mean, maybe it is funny or whatever, but we're all on the same kind of page, on we're on the same side or whatever. There's no, you know, I'm doing this, you're doing that, and you know, like pushing aside or whatever, like get out of my way or whatever. It's like, you know, it's still there or whatever, like, of helping each other and stuff like that, you know. Therefore, like, even the collective galleries, artist galleries, and so forth.
I also think, to answer your question, Marianne, I think that the commercial gallery structure prior to, say, 2007, 2008, around the time of Prospect, really was, it was a bottleneck. And for all the hundreds, let's just say several, the thousand odd artists in New Orleans, it was extremely limited. I mean, they were simply not permitted access, you know, to the couple of commercial galleries that actually succeeded in selling work. You had to really wait until a certain age. You had to just have a certain success on your own before you'd be accepted. And I think exacerbating that is this kind of schlock folk art that comes out of New Orleans that actually is very commercially successful along the lines of the Blue Dog and, you know, other such things that have I think kind of inadvertently conspired to give that kind of like this idea of a successful New York painter, successful New Orleans painter, sorry, this almost cliched or stereotyped image. I think the cooperative movement has taken a lot of that pressure off, because now you have these kind of groups, these kind of, I don't know, councils of 12 artists who run one gallery and 10 artists who run another gallery and 16 artists who run another gallery. And they all have enough of a cohesiveness amongst themselves that they then can form these larger clusters. You know, so, and then they all have their own satellite artists. So the scene actually, I would say, successfully services 300 or 400 artists a year with very, very little money changing hands, very little actual economic activity on a level that one might like. But again, in the absence of that money and in the absence of maybe many people who believe that that's their due or that that's actually going to happen for them, other values seem to fill in to take that gap. And I don't want to make it seem like it's just one big happy village of, you know, kind of crazy and inexplicably delighted citizens. But, you know, having come from the East Village, I mean, in the East Village in New York in the 80s, which I did know very well, I'm struck that there are a lot of parallels, that as much as the East Village was about parodying this idea of a communal art world, it also was a communal art world. It actually served that function. And artists ran galleries and showed other artists, and the art was all very cheap. And yes, there were people who were jealous, and yes, there were people who were bitter. And we certainly know people, you know, in New Orleans who think, you know, they were the original St. Claude, you know, co-ops, or there's, you know, there's some street art that just never seems to get in. And I will also say that there's still a very big problem of segregation in New Orleans, that there's an inheritance from Jim Crow that effectively prevents younger African Americans or even older African Americans from knowing about art, from being trained in art, of seeing themselves as artists. And, you know, the brain drain of New Orleans is where young people grow up and look around and at age 20 say, I'm getting out of here. If I'm going to do anything with my life, I have to get out of here. Well, that's still a very, very big factor, particularly among African Americans. So, you know, it's not as if it's all just hunky-dory and peaches, but I do feel that the community that's been creative is extraordinarily, it's striking to me in its almost total absence of rancor and competition. Artists love other artists, and they're always excited. I've never heard bad words spoken by artists about other artists in New Orleans, and I think I'm listening for that. I like gossip. I mean, if people were backbiting, I think I'd be aware of it. But it's just,
it's warm.
It's very, very.
Yeah, it's warm. It's a small town. Maybe you have that here too. You know, this, you want stuff to happen in your town. So if you do something, people just get on your side because they like that you're going to do something for your little town. You know, so if I say I'm going to do something, people just sign on right away to help because they want something to happen, bottom line. I love small town boosterism. I heard that was started, that was supposed to be a bad word, boosterism. I love it. I love small town boosterism. I love that feeling of people coming together to make something for themselves, for each other to share. And that's what it's like. It's really warm.
It's also, I mean, we see each other 4 times a week and we hang out in the same bars and we hang out in each other's studios. So if Sarah says something bad about me, I'll find out in like 6 hours and I'll know.
Yes. Well, that's Julia Street really is the center of the commercial gallery. The number one gallery in New Orleans is Arthur Roger. And I think Arthur represents about 40 artists, perhaps at least 35 of whom are still alive and working, part of the community. I would say the next most successful is Jonathan Ferrara. And he's really more of like the cutting edge, the new generation, sort of the outsider coming up and plucking artists from St. Claude. The low-hanging fruit, and managing to have a lot of success from that. There are galleries, Lemieux Galleries, Harry Archimino Galleries. There are a couple that are doing interesting work, but for a long time, that was all that there was, and that was sort of the Soho of New Orleans. And I think at a certain point, it peaked, and the ability for Julia Street to serve the artist community kind of It was over by 2000, probably long before the storm. I mean, I think that there was a frustration level in the artist community about not having any outlets and not having curators who cared about them and not having institutions who cared about them. That was really, really, I think, I mean, I wasn't there. I was only a tourist at that time, but I hear, and it seems to have been pretty bad 10 years ago.
St. Claude blossoming has really thrown a wrench in their plans as well. They're forced to show, you know, more engaging art, or they'll just get dismissed by, you know, any type of criticism or people. So many people now coming from outside the city to see it, they're not stupid. They can say like, wow, this string of co-ops, like there's, you know, some great art here, and they can go through this string of commercial galleries and just walk in and out and dismiss a lot. So they're forced to change their attitudes and the way they view art, their artists they choose. Which, you know, is good.
Yeah, in that sense, it reminds me a little of like San Francisco in the early 90s, you know, where you would go to the commercial galleries and you'd be like, eh. And then you go to all the alternative spaces mm-hmm. and you'd be like, wow, there's so much exciting work being done here. It's almost entirely in the not-for-profit realm. Well, the co-ops aren't not-for-profits, but they're barely profits.
Yeah. Out of pocket.
That's pretty close to being, well, what's the demographic, what's the racial demographic of the city now? Is it still like 60-40?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's 60% African American. I would say the art world is less than 20% African American. There are two noteworthy galleries run by African American dealers and showing African American artists and selling it to primarily African American clientele. Beyond that, there is some integration, but not that significant. And one of the things we discovered with Prospect 1.5 is that certain artists who had left the city and who we were inviting back really had not ever thought of themselves as having a career at all in New Orleans or any kind of professional relationship to the city. That was back where their families lived and where they visited during Christmas. That it wasn't really a place to have, a gallery. I would say in terms of gender, the art scene is absolutely balanced, 50-50. One of the things that's a problem in the city is that there's vernacular contemporary art. I would single out Mardi Gras Indian practice in particular as being a contemporary visual art form that's intrinsic to New Orleans that was invented by the African American community and which is only in the last 10 years, say, kind of entered the discourse somewhat begrudgingly, as legitimized visual art practice. The New Orleans Museum of Art, when Tutti Montana made his 50th suit as a Mardi Gras Indian, which meant he was due for a half-century retrospective, they gave it to him. They finally opened up their galleries and gave him the retrospective he deserved. I think it was in 2004. And then we included Victor Harris as one of the participating artists in Prospect One, also showing at NOMA. There's self-taught art, which is a very big tradition. One of the artists in the exhibition here at Ballroom in March, one of the living artists, I should say, is completely self-taught. He grew up in one of the projects and began making drawings in his grandmother's kitchen. Another one who's deceased is also self-taught, and they're both African-American. So you do have this very particular strand of, there are a lot of white artists with master's degrees and a lot of non-white artists who are self-taught, and trying to find one framework in which all that work can be enjoyed and shared and appreciated it's an intellectual struggle. It takes a lot of thinking about, you know, who's the audience and who's the artist.
Is it fairly international?
Is the community international? I would say probably not so much. There's certainly a Hispanic community that's been very prominent in the last 10 years, but their presence in the art world is almost not there. I mean, not that visible. A smattering of Eastern European artists. No, it's actually true. There are three or four. But no, artists moving to New Orleans from Europe, say, or from Asia, no, hasn't happened yet. Yes.
No, I mean, I'll integrate Marfa into being in New Orleans, so that means Marfa becomes a little more New Orleans, that's all. I haven't had that much time to spend on anything, kind of got ushered around, and it's been a quick time since leaving the plane. So I think on the next trip, I think we're going to spend more time here.
One of the things we did talk about before the panel was, we sort of said, is there something that you could point to about the sort of some shared visual characteristics amongst the artists in the exhibition to say, well, that's kind of a New Orleans style? And we couldn't. I mean, it's very hard to point to something and say that comes from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can right now. Or
it's pretty. I mean, it's diverse. I mean, that's what makes New Orleans. Or I mean, it makes a lot of places what it is. It's a lot of things being put together. I mean, it becomes location becomes what makes you. A group of artists, and not necessarily all working in the same vein or look the same way. And I think that's probably true for a lot of places. I guess, I don't know. I don't live in a lot of places, so. it's hard to say. I would imagine it's that way. I can't say definitely, though. I don't know.
I mean, we've only been here 2 days, but I mean, we've fallen in love with everything we've seen here.
Yeah. It's like we're all talking about.
No, seriously. I mean, it's such a lovable town. Yeah, like if I lived here, I would live here forever and love it.
Yeah.
You know, and the beauty of the landscape that surrounds this place is staggering to us, and it's all made up. Is that what you said? Oh, let's all make out. I think he said it's all made up.
See, that expanse of landscape is like there's something you can't see.
And that gorgeous silver blimp. My God.
Yeah, the silver blimp that tells you where Prada Marfa is.
The drug blimp?
Yeah. Well, this would not have happened if, you know, if, again, if Ballroom Marfa hadn't, I mean, if Fairfax and Virginia in particular had not personally been investing their own time and energy in trying to play a role in New Orleans recovery. And I think that had a lot to do with their seeing the art itself, but also the city and the particular kind of characteristics of the city. So, you know, this is an experiment. It's kind of like a graft or something where, you know, we're coming in to give you the best of what we have, but we don't really have much beyond that to prepare you or lay the groundwork for what the exhibition is actually going to be. Ten.
And how many women of
those? Four? Or it's 11 artists and five are women. One of those two. I think it's 11 artists and five are women. Our life challenge? Well, two, I mean, Sister Gertrude Morgan passed away in the 60s. Noel Rockmore passed away in the 70s. Michael Smith passed away 2 years ago. I think it's just those three.
Roy Kahn.
Oh, Jules Kahn, I'm sorry. Roy Ferdinand, sorry. So five of the artists in the show actually are no longer with us. But two of those five would be with us today if they hadn't died. That doesn't make any sense.
What?
No, I mean, they're not. We don't think of them as artists from the past. Let's put it that way. They're artists from this era. They're just not productive.
Yeah, some got taken early in their life. They should be on this panel. Like, a couple of them should.
Yeah, but sometimes artists' life expectancy in New Orleans is just. It's probably lower than it is in the rest of the country, actually. Because Roy Ferdinand passed away when he was quite a young man.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey Cook, who's not in the exhibition, but he's an artist we all knew and admired, you know, passed away at a fairly early age. But, we'll have a lot of non-living artists in the show.
Yeah, I would imagine life expectancy in Marfa's got to be longer than New Orleans. This is like amazing place to like get away. I mean, as much as we're talking, you know, and everything is great in New Orleans, it's taking my hair away and giving me grace too. And just being here for a day is like I was telling Dan, like being here for a day is like a week in New Orleans or and probably a month in New York's time, I guess. It's like time slows down and it's amazing and it's incredible. And seeing these huge expanses of like landscape, like totally incredible. So like, yeah, it's even for just for a day, it's hard not to take Marfa back to New Orleans and tell everyone like you have to go. It's insane. You have to be there.
Get a shuttle service between the two.
I would like to just like bottle it and give everyone a little shot. And, like you have to, you know, be there. It's what an amazing place.
Do we have any more questions or comments? I'm enjoying this immensely, but I do have that nagging fear that we're on the verge of becoming a bore. So please, really, one more comments. Random. Yes.
So some artists will be here making work before the show?
Yes, these three will be making, and two more will be coming to make work for the show. But they didn't need to be here this far in advance. So we'll be like a snowball. Each time you see us, there will be more, and it'll be bigger. Exactly.
What's your favorite bar in the Marion?
Mimi's. But my
Cajun's Pub.
My best friend is open Siberia, so it's hard, you know, to not give her a shout out. So. Even though it doesn't even have a name on the bar yet, you just have to know where it's at. It's so cool. There's a lot of great bars. Hi Ho, Saturn.
I mean, for me as the visiting curator to see studios here in town.
No.
Oh, the other way around.
Are you going to be here working? I mean, how long are you here working before?
I don't think any of that's.
Stop by.
I don't think anything of that's hammered out.
It might be happening. I mean, we'll be having, you know, the walkthrough with the artist when the exhibition's done, but you mean a little bit prior to that, just to... Let's see if we can't do that. I think it'd be great. Well, listen, this has been wonderful for us. Thank you so much, all of you, for being here. Thank you to Ballroom Marfa. And really, have a wonderful evening, and come back in March. Hope to see you again soon. Thank you.